Welcome to session 266 of which is called Would Jesus Attend Sunstone? Before we begin, we'd ask you to silence your cell phones. Session's being recorded. You'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends, the registration desk on the main floor. We encourage you also to purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. Really, we could help it. We could use it. Your donations keep the organization going. We need it. Please become a continual supporter of Sunstone. I also want to mention, a whole lot of people have noticed like all the crafts rows, but I guess since you came to this session, you saw the art too, but the art is a little bit further away, and there's some really nice stuff there. Hope you'll take a look at that. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. Okay, about this presentation. Some Latter-day Saints feel that attending or presenting at Sunstone or publishing in Sunstone magazine or even reading it is inappropriate or worse, dangerous. I have a t-shirt that I wore yesterday of two people climbing up a rock face, and one says to the other, "You read Sunstone, isn't that dangerous?" Anyway. It's popular for Latter-day Saints and other Christians to ask, WWJD, what would Jesus do? This session attempts to answer this question in relation to Sunstone. Bob Reese is professor and director of Mormon Studies at Graduate Theological Union. He has just completed editing the second volume of Why I Stay, The Challenge of Discipleship for Contemporary Mormons. Bob.
Thank you, Kim. Kim and I go a long way back. I begin this session by saying if I use the word Mormon and Mormonism, which I will, it's not out of disrespect, but rather because there are some instances in which there is no adequate substitute for either word. Mormonism, since I'm director of Mormon Studies at a university, Mormon Studies is different from Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Studies. I begin with two short poems by Rumi. The first one, when one of us gets lost, is not here, Jesus must be inside of us. There's no place like that anywhere else in the world. The second Rumi poem, where Jesus lives, the great-hearted gather. We are a door that is never locked. Stay near this door and open it if you suffer any kind of pain. I begin with a kind of midrash. Jesus invites the despised and sinners to eat dinner with him, a parable for our times. As Jesus walked along the streets of Salt Lake City, a large crowd followed. He stopped at Temple Square and began to teach them. As the sun began to set, he realized that, like him, they were getting hungry, so he asked Mary, one of his close friends who lived nearby, if he could invite some of these people to have dinner with them at her house. She said they would all be welcome, so he sent some of his disciples to Whole Foods to buy some good food. Jesus turned to the crowd and said, I can't invite all of you to Mary's house, since there's room for only a dozen. But I've instructed my disciples to buy enough food so that the rest of you can have a picnic at Pioneer Park. He then turned to those gathered around him and pointed to the ones he had chosen to share a meal with him. Among them were a homeless woman, a blind intellectual, an orphan in a wheelchair, a divorced Democrat, a lesbian libertarian, an excommunicated bishop, a gay returned missionary, a gang member, a devout Muslim, a drug-addicted prostitute, a reader of Sunstone, and a drinker of coffee. As they sat at table, Jesus welcomed them warmly, and then he asked the Muslim to say grace. Afterward, he broke bread and drank wine, and with them in full fellowship as they ate to their full, including chocolate eclairs and key lime pie for dessert. After dinner, Jesus taught them in parables and poetry. When the teachers of the law, the Pharisees, and the pure and pious saints heard that Jesus was actually eating with such people, they were outraged and greatly offended that he hadn't invited them to eat with him. They asked his disciples, "Why does your master eat with scholars and sinners, with gays and gangbangers, with liberals and lesbians? Doesn't he know who these people are?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "Don't you know that I am their Lord as well as yours? My father and mother have sent me to redeem all their children. If they were all as righteous as you claim to be, they would have no need of a Savior. If you are truly my disciples, you too will invite these and others like them into your homes and into your hearts." End of parable. Many years ago, when I was editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought, two bright, young, enterprising Latter-day Saints, Peggy Fletcher and Scott Kenny, came to see me about a new magazine they were starting. Impressed with their vision and passion, I asked them to tell me more about it. They said they felt the Mormon community needed an independent magazine that would deal with Mormon thought, religion, and culture in a more current and less academic way than Dialogue. I was impressed and promised to send them any manuscripts I thought they might be of interest. They might be of interest to them. When I asked them that we were thinking of naming their magazine, one of them said, "Whetstone." I thought about that, then I said, because I was editing an issue of Dialogue with an image of the sunstone of the Nauvoo Temple on the cover, suggested that they consider Sunstone as a name. In an essay I published in Sunstone 4 years ago, titled "Sun plus Stone equals Sunstone," I tried to explain why those two archetypal symbols, central to Christianity, Mormonism, and Western civilization, constituted an apt name and constitute an apt name for the magazine and the symposium. And this is what I said. For 40 years, Sunstone has provided a lively place for exploration and discussion of all things Mormon. As an open forum that attempts to cover the whole of Mormon experience, scholarship, issues, and art, it has been at the center of many of the critical issues in Mormon religion and culture, the good, the bad, and the ugly, but also the true, the good, and the beautiful. While it is true that Sunstone Symposia and Sunstone Magazine have dealt with many of the most controversial issues surrounding Mormonism, I think it is also safe to say that Sunstone has published some of the most significant, thoughtful, provocative, important, and inspiring expressions on Mormonism over the duration of its publication. In relation to this symposium, I added, the symposium has provided a forum for an astonishing array of discussions, dialogued explorations that have both challenged the axioms and expanded the horizons of modern Mormonism. Beyond this, both Sunstone, the magazine, and the symposia have made it possible for attendees to hear a number of creative expressions that provide insight into the lived experience of Mormons at the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st centuries. Future historians writing about this period will find in this enterprise, insights into Mormonism that cannot be found elsewhere. At times, Sunstone's future has been, or at least has seemed, imperiled. Nonetheless, in spite of inevitable missteps, occasional wrong turns, financial challenges, and periodic disarray, Sunstone has survived. While as an open forum, it has had its share of cranky dissidents, pious devotees, egotistic haranguers, Pharisaic pontificators, and downright naysayers, it has also been the source, both the magazine and the symposium, of some of the most significant expressions on issues related to Mormonism in the modern church. Simultaneously, Dialogue including stimulating dialogue, impassioned pleadings, uplifting and sometimes heartbreaking personal stories, refreshing humor, personal voices, poetry, fiction, sermons, and drama. The original organizers and editors of Sunstone envisioned their endeavors furthering the mission of the church. Given its nature as an independent forum and the religious, social, and political issues that have swirled around and within the church, especially since the advent of the internet, it was inevitable that at times such independence would put Sunstone at variance with church policies and practices. Considering the importance and urgency of some of the critical issues that have faced the church over the past four decades, including racial, feminist, historical, cultural, and relational, especially in regard to gender and sexual orientation, one could argue that Sunstone has played an essential, if for some, uncomfortable role, both for it and for the church. Sunstone was and is an experiment, one initiated, I contend, and largely continued in good faith. Whatever its faults and failures, I found the leadership and editorship anxious to address and correct them. Sunstone has evolved over the decades and to a large extent adjusted to changing trends. I remember I read recently a letter that Scott Kenny wrote, or no, maybe it was Gene England, wrote to the early editors. No, Scott Kenny saying that they expected that Sunstone would always be in harmony with church teachings. The young have idealism. Anyway, over the decades and to a large extent, Sunstone has adjusted to changing trends. I think it's important to understand its purported function and role in the contemporary church. Before doing so, let me give my personal experience and perspective. I have attended and presented at most of the Salt Lake Symposia over the past 40 years, and I've also presented at various regional symposia. In total, I estimate that I've made over 100 presentations at Sunstone Symposia, at least 90 of them this year. In addition, I have published over 30 articles, essays, reviews, and poems in Sunstone, and for a brief period of time, served and was chairman of the Sunstone Board. As various editors of the magazine would attest, at times I've also been a caring critic of both the symposia and the magazine, as well as the management and organization of the enterprise itself. While recounting all of this may suggest that I am a biased commentator, I do so to establish the fact that I know Sunstone organization and the Sunstone community very well, and I have cared and do care and will continue to care about their success. While I admit that I'm not a neutral commentator on the question I ask at this presentation, would Jesus attend Sunstone, I nevertheless consider it an important question, especially given the state of things in the contemporary church. I know there are people who question my membership in the church and my devotion based on the fact that I do speak and Sunstone and write and publish in the journal. Before answering the question of whether Jesus would come to Sunstone, let me say a few words about why I think that's an important question, and why I think it's important to ask Sunstone this. Christer Stendahl, former Lutheran Bishop of Sweden and Dean of Religion at Harvard, counseled people about understanding another religion. He said, you should ask the adherents of that religion and not its enemies. I found that very helpful in my teaching at Graduate Theological Union. If you want to learn about Mormonism, learn about it from someone who has lived it. So, what did the leaders say? Well, from this year's program, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a vibrant religious tradition with a diverse membership that has widely differing needs. For many Latter-day Saints, one of those needs is free and frank exploration of gospel truths as they relate to the complexity of today's society. Some come craving stimulating discussions of contemporary issues. Others find great comfort being able to read, hear, and share personal faith and journey and all of its twists and turns and occasional uncertainties. And Sunstone now in all of its material speaks about the importance of respect for differing positions, whatever they may be, and respect for all kinds of people. The Symposium Code of Conduct states, "We welcome the honest ponderings of all individuals and expect that everyone speaking or attending the symposium will approach every issue, no matter how difficult, with intelligence, respect, and goodwill." In truth, Sunstone is not for everyone, but then that is true of every organization and enterprise. Some, including me, at times have found the tone and style of Sunstone authors and speakers uncomfortable and occasionally even disturbing. In spite of the organizer's intent to maintain civil and respectful standards, in the past, some articles and presentations have tended to be disrespectful and strident and intolerant. In addition, I found some regional symposia unfairly imbalanced toward the negative, and I've said so to the organizers and have found them responsive. They say, "We don't want it to be that way. We want to keep it fair and balanced." Thus, on balance, I believe that Sunstone has played a constructive and in some ways invaluable and even indispensable role for both Latter-day Saints and for Mormon culture. If nothing else, it has created a community of people who come together to find friendship and fellowship around ideas and issues related to the Latter-day Saint religion and culture. I find it positive that people who come to Sunstone and who read the magazine stay connected both to the church and to Mormonism, even if that connection may be unorthodox for some and tangential for others. I see their involvement as evidence of the vitality and durability of the Restoration and its power to engage people's faith, intellect, and imagination. I imagine Joseph Smith imagined Sunstone as part of the flowering of the Restoration. So even when people have lost faith in the church and its doctrines, lost faith, trust in church leaders, many of them find this is a place they would like to be. By that I mean that most people who lapse from or who leave Mormonism generally do so not because they are apostates or sinners, but rather, as Jana Reese demonstrates in her book, The Next Mormons, for more complex and substantive reasons, such as the church's conservatism on social issues. A friend of mine, David Ulster, has just published a new book, which you can buy, called Bridges for People, for Those Who Question. He did a survey, which was really interesting, asking why people leave, and he gave a list of things. People leave because they want to sin, for example, or they're rebellious. And he gave the survey to church leaders and to people who've left. And it was really interesting on the question of whether people leave because they're sinning and are against the church. Church leaders found that I think 70% or more of them felt that's why people leave. When he asked people who left why they leave, it was only 10% said that. So he saw this enormous gap between the experience and the perceptions of people who have left the church and the people who are in the church, or at least in terms of the church's leaders. Others are unable to make the church work in their lives, often after years of trying. Very few people just say, "I'm just going to leave the church." Most people who leave the church stay and try to find a way to make it work until they can no longer do that. Some find an alternative community, but many don't. I think this is a very sad thing, that most Latter-day Saints who leave don't go to another church. And I think that's the fault of our emphasizing the one and only true church, that if this isn't it, maybe there isn't one. So the people stay connected to the faith. If they do so, often out in their own fashion, by attending Sunstone and reading the magazine, that's a good thing. Better that they are here then they are not any place where there is a community. So some Latter-day Saints find that Sunstone provides that community, even if it's an alternative community, what one finds in the typical Latter-day Saint congregation. Beyond that, Many who come to Sunstoning to read the magazine do so because they find not just fellowship, but inspiration. Even in some of the things I've said, occasionally someone said, that was inspiring. I said, whoa, you were awake. Some find love, nurture, companionship, especially among those whose faith journeys parallel their own. Many find answers to troubling questions. Many find questions to troubling answers. Some find hope that they can continue to stay in the fold of the gospel, if not the church. Others find encouragement that they can put troubling questions on the shelf. It's one of the things that I think it was Lowell Bunyan said to me. I've got a shelf where I put questions that God and I are going to have a conversation about when we get together in the next world. Some find encouragement that they can put troubling questions on the shelf. Still others find their testimonies strengthened and deepened. Even at Sunstone, people find their testimonies strengthened and deepened. Let me give one example of the kind of faith, hope, and love that I find at Sunstone. Some of you have just come from the wonderful session of Why I Stay. As I mentioned in my introductory comments there, people come, that session is so popular that nothing else is scheduled at the same time. Some of, over the years, some of Mormonism's most thoughtful, faithful, and respected Latter-day Saints have participated in that session, and we heard three of them today. Very different, very authentic, and really wonderful essays. 8 years ago, I edited a collection of the Why I Stay essays. It was published by Signature Books, and that volume contains a number of eloquent affirmations by Latter-day Saints about their faith. Here are some of the titles in that volume. It Takes Many Villages, Mary Bradford. Living Infinitely with Ambiguity, Armin Moss. It Satisfies My Restless Mind, Tom Rogers. With Neither Blind Faith Nor Blind Rejection, Chase Peterson. I Say to Serve and to Be Served, Molly Bunyan. And Everything I Ever Needed to Know, I Learned at Church, Claudia Bushman. I've just finished editing the second volume of those that will be published next year. It contains a number of the similar kinds of compelling testimonies of faith, hope, and love, including by Carolyn Pearson, Phil Barlow, Emily Thane, Dan Witherspoon, Jody England. I'm going to cite three brief examples from three of those. The first by Phil Barlow. This is in that next volume of Why I Stay. Phil says that the choice to remain a Mormon or to leave the fold is not merely a product of reason or belief. Our choices also entail emotion, intuition, spirit, relationships, commitments, values, and habits of character. I have found these elements conspire to enrich my Mormon life, to orient it toward noble aspirations and meaning, to afford a fine workshop for service and soul-making. I may be an idiosyncratic saint. Certainly I am a flawed one, but I thrive in the Mormon way. Emma Lou Thane, who one of our greatest women and one of our best poets who's no longer here. In her essay in that volume, she says, through allegiance, affinity, and affection, the pillars of my faith are still intact after so many years. And yes, the roof has blown blessedly off the structure to reveal a whole sky full of stars. And these words by Charles Shiro Inouye, though not presented at Sunstone, he wrote a beautiful essay I decided to include in my volume. And Charles says this, I don't know how much longer I'm going to live, but if I do live another day, I know I will try to spend it helping other people to feel God's love. My memory, in his essay, he talks about as a boy growing up in Sigard, Utah, his parents were part of the Japanese Americans who were put in concentration camps, and they found themselves in Utah. And he remembers going to the ward there, and he remembers the taste of the sugar cookies that as a young boy he ate in the Sigard, Utah ward. He says, my memory of the sugar cookies that the Sisters of the Sigurd Utah Ward baked for me when I was a young boy is still with me. They filled me with love and wonder then. The memory of them fills me with the same love and wonder now. How could I have been so blessed? Despite the way we Latter-day Saints sometimes mess things up, some of us do understand God's love for everyone. That's why I'm here. That's why I stay. I stay, Charles writes, because I want to learn how to love the world. I want to master the Zen of Zion. Isn't that a beautiful concept? The Zen of Zion. I want to master the Zen of Zion. Nothing matters so much. Well, one looks at the list of presentations for this particular symposium, one can't help but being impressed with how much seriousness is at play these 3 days, four counting Wednesday. So many presentations focus on central issues related to the Latter-day Saints, including the Book of Mormon, climate change, the faith crisis, interreligious dialogue, the temple, mixed faith marriages, feminism, Heavenly Mother, polygamy, sex abuse, marital relationships, grace, politics, church history, stages of moral development, seeking consensus, feeding malnourished children, and other subjects. In addition, one finds expression of Latter-day Saint faith in culture, in the poetry, fiction, art, drama, and humor that are offered here. It has been popular for decades for Christians to ask, what would Jesus do? The acronym WWJD is found on bracelets, pins, banners, billboards, and preached from pulpits. The challenge is others to ask a question, presumably people who propose this have already answered for themselves, and Jesus, they conclude, would likely do just exactly what they do. I venture that most of those who ask the question, whether in relation to religion, politics, relationship, or social values, believe that their choices mirror those of Jesus. What would Jesus do? Exactly what I'm doing, they would say. As Mormon Christians, we can't avoid the challenge of at least some variation of that question. Perhaps it is better to let Jesus ask the question, which is precisely what he does in the Book of Mormon. What manner of men and women ought ye to be? He asks, verily I say unto you, even as I am. It takes a lot of study, work, and faith to truly know what kind of a man Jesus was and is. It's significant that Joseph Smith revised John 7:23 from Jesus saying, I never knew you, to you never knew me. It seems that Jesus, that is, there's no question that Jesus knows us. There is a question about whether or not we truly know Jesus. It seems to me that Jesus was willing to go wherever there were souls to be saved, burdens to be lifted, hearts to be mended. As a mortal, Jesus went into the desert, up on high mountains, into the wilderness, into the inner cities. We can assume from scriptures that he may have gone into prisons, brothels, palaces, dens of iniquity, and wherever the mystery of iniquity, that's a term that's always fascinated me in the scriptures, the mystery of iniquity. What does it mean? It means the secret power of lawlessness. I think there is the mystery of iniquity working places in our culture, in high places. Well, wherever it led him is where Jesus went. From both Peter and from the apocryphal Gospel of Nicodemus, we learn that Jesus descended into hell, or as Latter-day Saints speak of it, the spirit prison, to preach the gospel. Known in Christian theology as the harrowing of hell, this descent was to rescue sinners and those who had rejected the gospel. The Doctrine and Covenants gives an indication of the depths and extremes that Christ was willing to go to save us. In speaking to Joseph Smith, Jesus said, and if thou shouldst be cast into the pit or into the hands of murderers, and the sentence of death passed upon you, if you are cast into the deep, if the billowing surge conspire against you and fierce winds become your enemy, If the heavens gather blackness and all of the elements combine to hedge up the way, and above all, if the very jaws of hell gape open the mouth wide after you, know, my son, that the Son of Man hath descended below them all. Jesus has been literally everywhere. If Jesus would go to hell to save sinners, one might argue that he would also consider coming to Sunstone. So, would Jesus read Sunstone and attend Sunstone Symposia? From everything I read in the scriptures, and from all I know of disciples who try to follow him, I believe he would, as would Joseph Smith. And both would find and make fellowship here. Both Jesus and Joseph mingled with believers, non-believers, and unbelievers alike, as they did with apostles and agnostics, sinners and saints, heretics and holy people. Both of them loved vigorous engagement on important issues, and both taught that by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. That's what Sunstone is all about. It's important to acknowledge that the church has a right and a responsibility as a guardian of its doctrine and religious practice to establish and enforce principles of belief and behavior. It has legitimate concerns when people challenge core teachings, criticize leaders unfairly, or dismiss and disrespect things the church regards as sacred and holy. Sunstone has gotten in trouble in the past when certain people have talked about the temple in ways they shouldn't have, when certain people have criticized church leaders in language that I found embarrassing. I heard at a Sunstone Symposium a couple of years ago, someone spoke about the general authorities as being evil. And I stood up and said, that's not a term you can use. First of all, you're speaking about a great number of people, but you also have to acknowledge that you don't know their hearts. And to speak about them in that way is not only disrespectful and unfair, it's wrong. Nevertheless, that sometimes happens, and the church is right to be offended by some things that are said and done. But while Jesus dined with harlots and heretics, he also discoursed with and disputed with pompous clerics and Pharisees and his own disciples. And unless they were hostile, he tended to be loving and patient when they taught things at variance with his teachings. Keep in mind that some of the people who come to Sunstone have been deeply hurt by the church. And sometimes they come here to recover. Given the nature of an essentially conservative church, I'm just thinking about this. People who go through the 12-step program might consider coming to Sunstone the 13th step if they're Latter-day Saints. Given the nature of an essentially conservative church, the increasing secularism of modern society, which threatens all religious institutions, and the inevitable conflicts between a theocracy, which the church is, and a pluralistic democracy and society in which we live, it would be naive not to expect conflicts like those exist between the church and independent organizations and publications like Sunstone. In spite of goodwill efforts to avoid them, these conflicts also exist between the church and Dialogue, Exponent 2, the Mormon History Association, and other academic organizations, as well as a number of websites, blogs, and podcasts that, to one degree or another, are interested, concerned, and invested in what we used to call Mormonism. To paraphrase Judge Thomas Griffith, quote, there are high spiritual risks that accompany the practice of religion in a fallen world. Some who choose to run such risks without grounding their efforts in love magnify the risks exponentially. That is, it is a risk to have an organization like this. By and large, those who attend Sunstone and who read Sunstone magazine have a positive relationship with the church. I don't know how long it's been, Kim, since there was a survey done of people who attend Sunstone, but I remember 10 years ago some kind of a survey that presented evidence of how many of the people who attend Sunstone are faithful members of the church, pay their tithing, go to the temple, and who are devoted. So by and large, those who attend Sunstone and who read Sunstone magazine have a positive relationship with the church. Most have served the church over the course of their lives, including many having served full-time missions, and many continue to be active. While statistics aren't available, I would guess that the majority of Sunstone attenders and readers strive to live godly lives, including keeping covenants they have made with God. Even those who feel distant or estranged from the church come seeking fellowship, or at least acceptance. Some attend hoping for healing. It's important to acknowledge that some who have left, who are on the margins of the church, may be where they are as a result of our judgment and our failure to listen to their concerns, to welcome them into our homes and congregations. I was at breakfast yesterday morning with a man in Salt Lake, active member of the church. He said, over breakfast, I had a really good friend, a returned missionary, a gay man, who was married to a gay Mormon missionary, and who were excommunicated for that. And they have adopted three children. He came to me and said, "Could I ask you and your family to take our children to church? My husband and I love the church. We are who we are because of the church. We serve faithful missions for the church. We want our children to be raised in the church, and even though we can't take them, we're trying to find somebody who would." That story broke my heart because it said, here are people who want to be. A couple of years ago, let me tell you a very quick story. When I was bishop of the Los Angeles Singles Ward, good member from those, we members of that ward continue sometimes to speak about it as Camelot. We had a great time in that ward, and because I saw very early that that ward needed to be welcoming to gay and lesbian people, I had a number of gay and lesbian people from all over Southern California come to that ward. And I ended up giving an entire sacrament meeting once called No More Strangers and Foreigners, a Latter-day Saint Christian response to our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. But one of the people who came, who was not a member of the church, belonged to a large Catholic church in West Hollywood. It wasn't really Catholic. He was Catholic Episcopal, which is kind of in between those two churches. And he said, "Would you come and visit with me, worship with me?" And I said, "I'd love to." So on a Sunday, I went to worship with him. It was on a Pentecostal Sunday before Pentecost. And in that Catholic Episcopal Church was an organ that was built by a returned Mormon missionary. The organist who played that day was a returned Mormon missionary. The head of the congregational ministry was a returned gay missionary, and two others were. So there were five returned Mormon missionaries at this church. After church, and it's very touching. I wrote an essay called "Finding Christ" at St. John's Episcopal Church, published in Sunstone, because I did find Christ there among these worshipers. And after we went to lunch afterwards, and every single one of them talked to me about how they wished they could be in a Mormon congregation, how they missed singing the hymns of Zion. So some of the people who are here are people whose hearts have been broken and whose relation to the church has been broken because of who we are. So it is our failure to listen to their concerns, to welcome them into our homes and congregations, to make room for them in our hearts. It is important to remember that according to our theology, everyone who is at Sunstone kept their first estate. That's an important statement. And I think that all of who are here are also trying to keep their second estate. They too are among those Jesus came to redeem. My wife and I begin each day reading Richard Rohr's meditation. On July 16th, it was titled, Christ is Everywhere, and included the following personal witness from the 20th century English mystic Carol Hauslander about an experience she had as she was riding the London Underground. She wrote, all sorts of people jostled together, sitting and strap hanging, workers of every description going home at the end of the day. Quite suddenly, I saw with my mind, but as vividly as a wonderful picture, Christ in every one of them. I saw more than that. Not only was Christ in every one of them, living in them, dying in them, rejoicing in them, and sorrowing in them, but because he was in them, and because they were here, the whole world was here too. All of those people who had lived in the past, and all of those yet to come. I came out onto the street and walked for a long time among the crowds. It was the same here, on every side and every passerby, everywhere I saw Christ. I saw too the reverence that everyone must have for a sinner. Instead of condoning his or her sin, which is in reality their utmost sorrow, one must comfort Christ who is suffering in them. That is, when you're comforting them, you're also comforting Christ, she said. And this reverence must be paid even to those sinners whose souls seem to be dead, because it is Christ who is in the life of the soul, who is dead in them. They are his tombs, and Christ in the tomb is potentially the risen Christ. So when you look into them and see each of them, see Christ and see Christ risen in them. And she says this, Christ is everywhere. In him, every kind of life has a meaning, has an influence on every other kind of life. Realization of our oneness in Christ is the only cure for human loneliness. For me too, it is the only ultimate meaning of life, the only thing that gives meaning and purpose to every life. So in a sense, she is saying, everyone who is here at Sunstone is earnestly trying to live lives based on Christ's teachings. Christ is a man, let me start back up a minute. Christ is a man for all seasons and for all sinners. That is, all of us. His love and sacrifice are both democratic and universal. I believe he would hang out at Sunstone because he recognizes that most of those who attend Sunstone, as I was saying, are earnestly trying to live lives based on his teachings. Most people who come to Sunstone, the vast majority, repent of their sins, strive to keep Christ's commandments, and consider themselves his disciples. We can be sure Jesus would also want to mingle with those who don't know him, or who, having once taught and testified of him, which includes a number of returned missionaries, no longer feel that they can. He would want to spend time with those who are lost and lonely, who are confused and depressed, who carry heavy burdens of sin or estrangement, and who for various reasons no longer find fellowship among their fellow saints, those people who are not in our wards each Sunday. He would especially want to succor those whom we have failed to succor, give hope to those whom we have failed to give hope, and love those whom we consider the least and have treated as such. I would guess that most, if not all, of those whom we associate with at Sunstone have had occasion to lean on Jesus for repose. That lovely line we sang in the song that Kim directed us in the other day. The soul on Jesus, that soul who on Jesus have leaned for repose. How does the line go? I cannot, I will not desert to his foes. That soul whom, though all hell shall endeavor to shake, I cannot, I will, I never, no never, no never will forsake. That's how I look, as I hope people look on me when I'm at Sunstone. That I have had to, this very day, lean on Jesus for repose. As I think all of you have, at least recently. In the conclusion to the article I wrote for the 40th anniversary of Sunstone magazine, referred to earlier, I spoke of the rich and resonant symbolism of both sun and stone, including their association with Jesus. I then expressed my hope for Sunstone's future. Quote, my hope is that whatever else it does in the future, Sunstone and Sunstone magazine will strive to more fully and passionately reflect the religious culture of which it is a part, which is both the Church of Jesus Christ, however broadly one wants to define that term, and the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the scriptures and in Christian tradition, Christ is symbolized by both the sun and a stone. He is both the stone cut out of the mountain, spoken of in Daniel, and in Psalms, our sun and shield, and the chief cornerstone, spoken of in the New Testament. And according to the Doctrine and Covenants, quote, he is, I find this such a fascinating scripture. He is in the sun, and the light of the sun, and the power thereof by which it was made. Think about that when you think about that we were gifted with the light of Christ. We were all born out of light, whatever intelligence is. We know from the Doctrine and Covenants, intelligence is light and truth. We were organized out of light. We were given the Spirit of Christ as part of our inheritance, and we are also given the endowment of the Holy Ghost. Thus, according to Scripture, we are, in fact, the disciples of He who is a sun and a shield. Considering Sunstone's promise, I also said in this essay, as far as the future of Sunstone is concerned, I hope the current board and editorial staff will return to those archetypal symbols associated with its name and its beginning for inspiration and direction. Today, my hope is that all of us, those of us who feel comfortable attending Sunstone and those who don't, will see Jesus as our rock of ages, as our sun and shield. Would Jesus attend Sunstone? A friend of mine, a distinguished judge, who once served as a bishop and state president in Provo, sent to me something that he wrote when he was a bishop at BYU. He stood in that meeting and said to his flock, I bear witness to you today that if Jesus Christ were in Provo right now, he wouldn't be here. He would be at the mental hospital. He would be at the battered women's shelter. He would be counseling and comforting a migrant family from Ecuador. He wouldn't attend a single meeting that we're attending today. So why are we here? Because, he says he would attend. Why wouldn't he be here? Because he has you covered by your bishop and your Relief Society president. My witness is that if the Lord were to come to Provo today, he would spend time at the state mental hospital, battered women's shelter, visiting recently arrived family from Central America. That's where he would be. Then what are we doing here in a comfortable setting at church? actually doing something very important. We're here to partake of the sacrament, encourage one another to trust in Christ and follow him. But we can do that in 3 hours. Now, blessedly, 2. And when our meetings are over, this good bishop said, let us go where the Lord would be. Would Jesus attend Sunstone? Look around. Thank you. We have some time for questions or for anything else that anyone might want. If you have a question or some statement, you can use that microphone right there. Yes, come up. Peggy's doing fine. Scott's doing fine. I think that, as I was, when I was the age they were when they came to see me, I was still, I didn't really grow up, and my wife will tell you I still haven't, but I was full of idealism. I can't tell you what happened to me the day I was in graduate school and the first issue of Dialogue came across my desk. Got into the mail. I sat down and read it from cover to cover, and I thought, wow, this is so exciting. This is the church I belong to. There are people who have produced this. So Peggy and Scott, I think, were full of that kind of idealism, but very soon I think they, as all of us do, we fall upon the shoals of practicality and realize that Scott's idea that Sunstone would be pretty much in keeping with church teachings. I think pretty soon it began to be something different. What it is today is something different than what it was when it began. But the magazine spawned the symposium, and the symposium has become, I think, a very dynamic part of Mormon Latter-day Saint community. And as I said earlier, the fact that there are Latter-day Saints who are not in the wards and not in their pews, but are here, I see as really positive. Why are they here? Because they care about this community. They care about this thing that has had such a profound impact on their lives. Any returned missionary has to admit that part of who he or she is a result of what they were brought up, but mainly because of who they understand themselves to be. When I served almost 4 years in doing humanitarian service work for the church in Eastern Europe. My wife then, who since has passed away, and I were called, we were the only members of the church in the entire country of Lithuania. It was wonderful. There was nobody there. We were part of the St. Petersburg Russia mission, and so that was a long way from where we were. The most exciting thing to me about the work that we did, and when we, as I said, we started, there was not a single member of the church. When we left 3.5 years later, there were 3 wards headed by local Lithuanian members. The most exciting thing to me was to talk to people who had grown up under the Soviet system, who did not believe in God, who had this cold, rationalistic view of the world. And when they learned that not only were they a child of God, but through the things that they taught, that God knew them and God loved them, it changed their lives. The Soviets turned the churches into museums of atheism under their occupation. And now the churches were being turned back into places where people could worship. But this little branch in Kaunas, Lithuania, people come in, you could see the light in their faces. I said this in another session, that I was walking down the main... I worked to bring... work with Bonneville International to bring church programs, to bring films and videos and other things to Lithuania. And one of the things I did was to get the young ambassadors to come there and perform. And I told a friend of mine, I said, you know, they're coming on a certain day, and I'd kind of forgotten about it. And then she said, I saw your people on Laisvės Alėja. Laisvės Alėja is Free Street. She said, I saw your people on Laisvės Alėja. And I said, how did you know they were ours? She said, by the light in their faces. So that is what Christ brings to us, is that light. The particular aspect of that restored through Joseph Smith was additional light. Now, what Joseph Smith did was bring more light into through the restoration. And we are inheritors of that light from Christ and through Joseph Smith and from other prophets and through great teachers from all religions, that to know that we are, as Paul calls us, children of light. And so if people are here at Sunstone, they're seeking that light, and they're also bringing that light. And that's one of the reasons, and that's the main reason I think Jesus would be here. Thank you for your question. Anybody else have anything to say? Yes, Brother Kimball, can you, they want you, yes, they want, because this is being recorded. If you want to be anonymous, I won't tell him you are. But you certainly look an awful lot like President Kimball's grandson.
Too late. Jesus was challenged a few times for breaking bread with sinners and others of ill repute. I don't know whether you've already spoken to this, but I'd ask you to speak about whether Sunstone has that ill repute label that others who are not here might be worried about whether they will also be chastised for rubbing shoulders with shoulders with us.
So I take you back to dialogue, and one of the things that I tried very hard as the editor of dialogue, as the previous editors and others, did to keep a balance, to have a real dialogue. I found that after the announcement about alternative voices and symposia, I found that increasingly difficult. So that in a sense, what happened is that what some people feared would happen, which was that Sunstone would lead and dialogue would lean further and further left, was not by design, but by kind of default, because many of the people who could be here and could keep that dialogue balanced don't feel this is a safe place for them to be. In fact, they feel like it is similar to eating with sinners and taxpayers. Yes, but I respect anyone who makes the decision to be where they are, because I think that in the stages of moral development, we have to allow for people to, you know, as Kohlberg in his wonderful essay on the paradigms of spiritual growth, which I published in an article, I think it was in Steinock or Sunstall, called Forgiving the Church and Loving the Saints, Spiritual Evolution and the Kingdom of God. Because in a truth, we all are at different stages. Sometimes we are at stage 3 or 4. Sometimes we're operating on stage 1 or 2. Occasionally, we rise to stage 6, where Jesus and Buddha and other people are, but we don't stay there very long. We're all in this trajectory. It is a plan in which we are moving. And sometimes we go up and sometimes we come down. And I was listening the other day. I'll give you a personal example of that. Like all of us, I sometimes feel I'm somewhat enlightened. And then I remember that the Buddha says, if you think you're enlightened, it's a clear indication that you're not. But I was listening to a podcast with Thomas McConkie that was conducted by Terrell Gibbons, and Terrell was saying something about, I think the question was something like, as you look forward, people will be, see all the great work you're doing and how you will feel about that. And Tom said something like, I hope nobody even mentions me. in the future having done anything, that should go to God, to Christ, or whatever his measure was. And I said, I wish I could say something like that. I wish I were humble enough to be able and evolved enough to be able to say what Thomas did, because in my mind, I imagine at my funeral, everyone weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and why didn't Bob Reese live to be 120? Because he was so important to us. How can we get along without him? That's kind of the imagination I have. So as we evolve in these stages, sometimes we're up here, sometimes we're not. And that's why it's important for us to remember that people who may be critical of those of us who come, they may at some time in their life find one of their kids here looking for the truth they didn't find in their home. As many parents who have gay children have found that those children are finding comfort in someplace other than their home or their ward. So it behoves all of us to be a little humble and to recognize. I think Sunstone works for a lot of people, and I think that it plays a role for many people that is an essential role. Any other observations or questions?
We're out of time, but thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you all for coming. And as you walk out and go down the hall and go to other stations, remember, in all the faces you're looking at, you're seeing Jesus. And they, looking back, also see Jesus.